Welcome to AMA Edgewise. I'm Dave Summers. AMA Edgewise is brought to you by the American Management Association. Our guest on today's program is Nicole Lipkin. Nicole is a sought-after speaker, consultant. She holds a doctorate in clinical psychology as well as an MBA. She has shared her expertise on NPR, NBC, CBS, Fox Business News, and other high-profile media outlets. She's the author of a great new book entitled What Keeps Leaders Up at Night, and it's published by AMACOM, a division of the American Management Association. Nicole, welcome to Edgewise.
Thanks, Dave.
Why and how do employees go from being engaged to disengaged so quickly? I mean, and what can be done about it?
You know, Dave, that's really a great question, because engagement is probably one of the most critical, yet the most elusive factor in the workplace. You know, it's kind of hard to describe, but we certainly all know it when we feel it or see it, especially when it's disengagement that we're talking about. So the way I like to think about it is that people go from totally pumped and engaged to seriously deflated and disengaged because of a breach of something called the psychological contract. The psychological contract is a person's belief about the mutual obligations that should exist between an employer and an employee. And some are stated obligations and tangible obligations, like if you give me pay and benefits, I'll give you work output and time and hours. And some, of course, are unstated and intangible, like you provide me with a positive work culture and opportunity, and I'll give you commitment, loyalty, and effort. The thing is, a psychological contract is formed, and it's a very, very, very powerful contract. And it comes from our previous work experiences, our expectations we've developed over time about what work should be, and our experiences and information learned from the minute we walk on site and interview at the job and meet with colleagues and begin our work. And obviously, the contract evolves both ways over time as expectations develop and as we start melding into the culture. The thing is, disengagement often happens when there's a breach of this contract, because it's such an important thing for people. And these breaches, as I'm sure some of us listening have experienced, come about for a variety of reasons, like violations of trust, actions that lack honesty and integrity, behaviors that violate ethics or the law that go extreme, promises that get broken, assignments that intrude on personal time and work-life integration, when job descriptions and expectations are ill-defined, environments or cultures that are difficult and depressing, and really important, when leaders drastically alter the deal and don't behave or act the way they kind of promised they would. And these breaches that lead to disengagement are so critical for two really, really important reasons. First of all, and the obvious reason, is research has consistently shown, and I'm talking from the big companies, the big research companies like Gallup or Bless & White, have consistently shown that disengagement can lead to a decline in productivity, a decline in performance, workplace safety, loyalty and retention, organizational citizenship behaviors, and overall the bottom line, your profits. But the other major problem with disengagement, if that stuff isn't enough, is that the negativity often associated with someone who's disengaged can lead to something called emotional contagion. And emotional contagion is where negative emotions spread virally, not only across a team, but can infect a culture and then trickle down to customers. And the reason why this happens, it's really fascinating. Our limbic systems, which are our emotional centers in our brain, do a kind of what I like to think of as a tango with one another. You know, for example, Dave, if you've ever been around someone who's chronically negative and down, you kind of start feeling really bummed and down around that person. And the opposite is true if you're around someone who's really upbeat or positive, not excessively annoyingly upbeat and positive, but, you know, those upbeat and positive people, you can't help but feeling kind of positive and happy. And we can't help it because we mimic one another. And when we smile around someone, those smile muscles produce hormonal and physiological changes that induce a feeling of happiness. And the same is true for anger or sadness. So having someone who's disengaged and doing nothing about it could potentially lead to way more damage than just one person's mojo simply being destroyed. So that's why it's so important and how quickly it could happen. And really what you can do about it is it really can be reversed with great leadership. I mean, first and foremost, when you see someone disengaged, that means taking the time to talk to that person immediately. And although that seems like common sense, a lot of us don't take the time because, first of all, we're all busy, and second of all, often we don't want to hear what's going on. But acknowledging the breach, remedying the situation if it can be, are really, really important basic things to do. But overall, I have this theory that I call the SLAM model. And the SLAM model is an approach to leadership or culture creation, and it involves a constant focus on social connection, leadership excellence, creating an aligned culture, and establishing a culture that supports meaningful work and life. Although it's way too extensive to get into for this interview, it's a way of thinking about people and work that works towards human nature rather than against it.
What are the one or two emotional biases that you think impact our business decisions the most?
Really good question. I think perhaps the most powerful emotional or cognitive bias that nabs us all from time to time in the workplace, and of course our personal lives, is confirmation bias. I like to think of confirmation bias as the glue that keeps us comfortably stuck in our own happy place in our heads. Basically, this bias causes us to see what we want to see and hear what we want to hear, you know, the thing we kind of love to do with our significant others. And it stems from the very, very normal human need to be right. And what we do, whether we realize it or not, is that we naturally tend to cling really tightly to our beliefs and look for information that confirms our beliefs while disavowing information that contradicts those beliefs. You know, for example, when you're watching political debates, even though both sides may have a point, you often see politicians clinging to the information that supports their view while completely dismissing the other side. And if you think about it, this can wreak havoc. However, when we're managing other people, it wreaks havoc when we're managing other people because it can prevent us from making accurate and effective judgments and decisions. It interferes, confirmation bias interferes with our ability to gather all sides of an argument, consider all possible points of view, and weigh a situation with a cool, objective mind. It diminishes what psychologists call situational awareness. So that's one that being aware of is so important, in self-awareness. And once you kind of start seeing it in action, you can't help but to start noticing it in other people and in yourself when it's happening. The other set of biases that really can cause massive problems in the workplace are the ones associated with change and decision-making that behavioral economists have been talking about for years. And one of my favorites is the sunk cost bias, and I'm personally guilty of it, and I've been guilty many times of it throughout the years. And you can kind of think of this bias this way. You go out to the mall to purchase a pair of jeans. You try them on in the mall. You spend money. You go home. You try them on, and all of a sudden they don't look good on you at all. And you have no idea what you were thinking when you bought them. So while you certainly can go back to that mall that's 45 minutes away and return them, you have sunk a lot of time driving to the mall, making the purchase, trying them on, driving home, taking off the tags, and so on. And going all the way back to the mall requires an additional investment, an investment that might persuade you to live with the new jeans after all, and also probably using the help of confirmation bias. So even if you do convince yourself to return them, you're never going to recoup all that energy and time. So basically, the more money, time, and effort you put into something, or the more you invest in something, the more binded you are to that investment. And the greater the emotional, financial, and time investment, the more binded we become, even if it's the worst investment ever. This bias in itself has brought down some massive companies and projects. For example, I'm sure you've heard of the Concorde plane, which was jointly funded by the British and French governments. It was an incredibly impressive but incredibly costly achievement. And over time, it increasingly became apparent that the Concorde was never going to achieve a return on the huge cost the two governments had sunk into it. So what did they do? Well, they sank even more money into it. Just kept on spending and spending and spending and not making the money back. So eventually they got it and pulled the plug. But this is something that has brought companies down and projects down when we just keep on investing over and over.
What are some ways that managers can help their people to cope more effectively with change?
It's a tough one, but an imperative one. And I'm not just saying this because I'm a shrink by training, but the first step is really to understand how the mind works and how our psychology can play funky tricks on us when it comes to change. I mean, being aware of all the different biases that happen when we're facing change, like sunk cost bias, status quo bias, loss aversion, the endowment effect, and these are just to name a few, is really imperative. It's also important to understand how simple exhaustion can play a huge role in our resistance to change, or even how a proposition of change is framed. I'm a firm believer in the fact that once you understand this information and buy into it, you absolutely need to teach it, because self-awareness is one of the most powerful weapons against resistance and bad decisions. So in short, I know that's a kind of simple answer. You can't shove change down people's throats and expect them just to oblige because I told you so. You can, but it won't work in the long run. I mean, change in itself triggers our flight-fight response, which is way more powerful than your do-it-because-I-said-so. And although people will follow the do-as-I-say out of fear and compliance, that is a sure way to disengage and create an us-versus-them culture or experience, and also ultimately create underperformance. Bottom line is change requires buy-in, and buy-in requires a solid why and a transfer or sharing of ownership. So in challenging this fight-flight response to change and the biases that keep us stuck in the mud, it's really helpful if you can include people in the process, even if you don't want to include people in the process, but include them in the process from the beginning, gain buy-in through influence, and help people understand how it will help them over hurt them. And the other really important thing, and I know this is kind of annoying to think about in the workplace, but when you're changing or you're adding something to people's jobs, allowing people to vent and naysay for a controlled period of time really helps, because it helps people free up their minds to actually look at the factors that they can control and the ones that they can't to start reshaping their approach. There are a few strategies that I discuss in the book to help leaders walk others through change, specifically aimed at challenging biases and reframing the problems or challenges that are keeping them stuck in the mud. But those are pretty extensive to go into.
Just curious, how come I sometimes act like the best boss in the world, okay? And other times I am obviously not. I approach being the best jerk in the world. Why does that happen?
Well, you're not alone. We all are. It really, David, happens to the best of us. And self-awareness and, of course, corrective action is at the root of what I call it like kind of the good boss gone temporarily bad syndrome. And when I think of reasons why you or I and everyone would go from being, you know, a really relatively good boss to all of a sudden being that jerk, I think of three reasons that kind of break us down. And the first is being way too busy to win. The second is being too proud to see. And the third is being too fragile to lose. So starting with being too busy to win, this speaks to a constant battle most of us are fighting in this crazy, workaholic, constantly wired and connected global community that we live in. Our brains are, first of all, totally evolving, and second of all, they're designed to filter information from our senses. And without the filter of our brain, we'd be absolutely nuts, because it only allows some information to come in, not every smell, every sight, every sound, and so on that you're experiencing. So our brain also acts to solidly push through all the stimulation we do receive. However, our brains are also like a shelf that you would buy from IKEA. You know, you set it up, and over time, you forget that the directions said max 50 pounds. So you keep piling books on that shelf and ignore the sagging middle, another book, and then snap, and you act surprised, like, what happened? So as this shelf starts sagging, our mood starts sagging too. When you're overwhelmed, you're constantly inundated and not paying attention to the fact that your brain's sagging, you know, that shelf sagging. Mm-hmm. We lose our temper more readily. We get more anxious. We procrastinate more, forget things, lose concentration. And you get into that kind of mode where you're stuck in writing a million to-do lists, but you're not doing anything. So when we start feeling this way, we think we might be multitasking and completely being awesome. But the fact is, as much as we'd all like to think we're great at juggling a million things, our brains at this point are not designed and have not evolved to the point where they can handle more than one cognitive task at a time. And you can't be a great boss when you're way too overwhelmed or busy. A ball or two is going to drop, and often that ball or two is directed at people, because it's very easy, and like I was talking about that emotional contagion, our emotions seep out of us. Mm-hmm. We can't control that. It comes out, even if you think you're very stoic.
Right.
But that stress, that needs to be managed. The next dilemma for that good boss gone bad, temporarily bad, is being too proud to see. And I already kind of talked about this with change, but it involves three problematic behaviors. The first is letting yourself get so tied to an idea that you won't let it go. The second is refusing to heed the advice of others. And the third is relying on your past successes at the expense of weighing different patterns, options, or solutions. And again, we've already kind of talked about this when we were talking about change, but this is the one that can have that massively devastating impact. You know, this is where confirmation bias creeps in and all those other cognitive biases that really can negatively influence leadership and decision making. Mm-hmm. And all three of these behaviors not only damage performance and productivity, they can very much undermine your credibility as a leader. And that requires, again, that awareness of what your cognitive biases are, how you look at change. It's tied into also being too busy to win. When you're so busy and when you're so overwhelmed, you don't necessarily think to take the time to stop and look at other options. Mm-hmm. Actually, other people presenting options can be frustrating. You just need to go ahead and do it. But being too proud to see can really lead to more than just a good boss temporarily gone bad. It can really lead to the good boss gone bad. And last but not least, you know, being too afraid to lose. I think we all kind of fall into this at times, what I call suffering from the too afraid to lose variation of being a good boss going bad. Tend to worry excessively about failing to get the right results, question and second guess every step along the way, avoid decisions and commitments that might cause mistakes, or get involved in every detail, particularly as deadlines loom. And these toxic behaviors can destroy, again, a leader's credibility. More than the other variations, this kind of thwarts creative problem solving and impedes team progress. And good bosses that fall into this trap often worry about appearing weak, and they mistakenly associate failure and mistakes with weakness and incompetence. The thing is, this false relationship causes them to behave kind of stupidly and out of character, micromanaging details or becoming immobile. And what is often underlying this is what psychologists call self-efficacy. It doesn't mean that someone lacks self-efficacy all the time. It just means that they may be temporarily suffering from it because of a personal situation, a new work situation or project, you know, a shifting culture, really anything, which ultimately impedes effectiveness. And again, we all go through times in life and phases in life where we're feeling way more confident in our abilities and then something might be thrown in our plate and it completely zaps us. Mm-hmm. So it happens. And at the end of the day, when you're looking at stuff like this, this comes down to self-awareness. And self-awareness begins with admitting that you're human and that becoming a boss does not make you infallible. So it's really easy in today's workplace where your natural neurological and psychological makeup has to cope with these constant huge pressures and crazy demands every minute of the day, you can easily lose your cool. Very easy to only see what you want to see or hear what you want to hear, or start succumbing to self-doubt and feeling increasingly powerless and inadequate. It happens to all of us, and these don't need to mire us in the quicksand of self-pity or self-destruction, which, you know, when we get to a certain level, those mess-ups really can just kind of completely deflate us. So it really does come down to self-awareness, pausing to kind of cast an objective eye on the unproductive behavior. This is when it's important to talk to a friend or a coach. And also, really importantly, when you have ventured into the temporarily bad boss territory, you need to make amends and acknowledge your behavior with the people around you. I mean, the worst thing you can do is pretend like it didn't happen. So really acknowledging, like, hey, I know I've been acting like this a couple of days or a couple of months, and trying to mend that team culture or your culture of your group you're working with.
Nicole, thanks for making me more self-aware. I feel better already. We've been speaking to Nicole Lipkin. She's the author of a phenomenal new book, What Keeps Leaders Up at Night, published by AMACOM, a division of the American Management Association. Nicole, thanks a lot.
Dave, thanks so much.
AMA webinars provide 90 minutes of focused how-to instruction and specific solutions for solving your most pressing work issues. For $149, you'll participate in an in-depth course taught by an expert who will answer your questions and guide you through the process a step at a time. For a complete schedule of upcoming AMA webinars, visit our events calendar at amanet.org/events. Here at the AMA, we value your feedback. If you've ever attended any of our webcasts, webinars, or seminars, you've no doubt encountered our feedback surveys. Well, our podcasts are no different. You can either email us at podcast@amanet.org or call 800-697-3406. Your comments may become part of a future program. Thanks for taking us along. I'm Dave Summers, and you've been listening to AMA's Edgewise.